You ask for miracles, Theo. I give you the Empire Podcast. Mm-hmm. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to a very special episode of the Empire Podcast, brought to you in association with our very lovely and talented chums at Sky Cinema and Absolute Radio. Why is this special? Well, because it's dedicated to one of the greatest films of all time, a light-hearted, feel-good romp guaranteed to give you the warm and fuzzies this festive season. I'm talking, of course, about Die Hard, which is available exclusively on Sky Cinema this Christmas. Why is it available this Christmas? Why is it available on demand from December 1st? Well, because it's a Christmas movie, of course, isn't it? Well, some say no, including the film star, Bruce Willis. So we decided to settle this definitively, once and for all. So here to argue the toss with me over the next insert minutes here are three of the finest diehard fans I have the pleasure to know, and none of them hopefully will be walking around the pod booth rug barefoot making fists with their toes. From Sky Cinema, we have a man who looks good in sharp suits. Not today, though. You disappointed me. He looks good in sharp suits with his finely calibrated facial hair. So is he Hans Gruber or Ellis? Either way, he's the face and voice of Sky Cinema, the wonderful Alex Sane.
Hello, thank you. Yeah, good to be here, Chris. Thanks for having me.
I am disappointed by the lack of a suit, Alex.
I'm sorry, it's winter out there. It's cold. I mean, I do have a wool suit. I wish
I
had worn it.
They do have suits for winter, you know.
I do. Yeah, they do have suits for winter. I've got my tights on underneath jeans. Too much already.
And the jodhpurs are a lovely touch. Really like it. From Absolute Radio, we have a studly man with magnificent stubble and, I'm guessing, a collection of white vests in his wardrobe. He is the host of the Absolute Radio Breakfast Show. He's just finished. You must be exhausted, Dave Berry.
I'm feeling good. I'm excited about this.
Yeah?
Yeah, blow the cobwebs off talking about Die Hard. No problems at all. I've got the vest on under the polo neck. Don't worry. I'll be revealing all.
You've got a vest. I've got tights. This is quite a lot.
If we put those together, we could be in the ballet.
I wonder what our next guest is wearing. From the Empire Podcast, we have our very own Walt down at Nakatomi, the contractually obligated James Dyer. How are you?
Lose the grid or you lose your job. I'm very good. Thank you, Chris.
I should point out, James can only respond in diehard quotes.
I already feel out of my depth.
It should be noted, this is not unique to this podcast either. This is just my general. I am wearing my Nakatomi Plaza t-shirt.
Oh, yes, you are.
From Last Exit to Nowhere. Rumour has it, Arafat buys his there. So that's good.
I have two.
I am so pleased I watched the film yesterday, so I'm keeping up to speed with all of these references. Those of you listening, trust me, these are really good for those of you who didn't watch Die Hard in the last 24 hours.
Imagine if you hadn't watched Die Hard, you were like already 3 minutes into this podcast, you'd be going, what the fuck is going on?
I mean, I get the vest bit. What's going on with the tights?
Who's Ellis? What is a James Dyer, honestly?
Just like Saigon, eh, Slick?
I was in junior high, Dick. I can't! Gotta stop.
We'll let you know when we commandeer your man.
Oh my God, we're going to need some more podcasters, I guess. Anyway, let's get on with this and let's talk about Die Hard. It's a film I'm sure we all love. Dave, you just watched it for the first time. But did you like it?
Yeah, it was all right. Anyway, I'll see you guys later on. Have fun.
See you next year for Die Hard 2, yeah? That's the one at the airport.
It's a great movie, and it was nice to revisit it. You know, we're obviously doing the podcast with you guys today. It was a nice excuse to dust it off, and it's as good as it always has been.
Do you need an excuse to dust it off, or do you dust it off around Christmas, Alex?
I mean, look, I know you mentioned at the start Bruce Willis saying, like, oh, it's not a Christmas movie. Yeah. He did that recently. But we have to take into account the circumstance in which he did that, which was during a comedy roast. And the one thing I think we've all met Bruce Willis at some point. I mean, he's got a unique sense of humour. And I think this was exactly the kind of thing that Bruce Willis does to just go, watch what's going to happen now. And sure enough, everyone's like, oh, Bruce says it's not a Christmas movie. It's not a Christmas movie. It is a Christmas movie.
Yes, he was making a joke, people.
Yeah. Well, he is, on the one hand, a professional troll, but also... Yeah. The fact, I mean, he said it's not a Christmas movie, it's a fucking Bruce Willis movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It is, of course, both.
There was an amazing thing that happened when we were working at MTV where Bruce Willis was in there, and the poor producer, because Bruce Willis can be quite difficult as well as a bit of a jokester, said to him, like, could you say, hi, this is Bruce Willis, you're watching MTV? And Bruce Willis looked at her and said, I think they'll know who I am. So I haven't had the pleasure of meeting Bruce, but I hear if you get some good stuff out of him, then, you know, as you say, he'll be talked about around the world, but he intimidates me. I don't know whether with the Christmas movie debate. And this is, as I say, I've just watched it. It's fresh in my mind.
Okay.
I don't think that from a script or any of the scenarios or any of the situations that the characters find themselves in, I don't think it's kind of really set at Christmas. I think it's almost like the props department had the only say in it being a Christmas movie. Because if you can sub out, like, now I've got a machine gun, ho, 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 you can get rid of that. You can get rid of
now
those...
Now I have a machine
gun,
happy Easter.
Exactly, you can theme it wherever. There's those massive office scapes, and there's just one kind of, like, snowman lamp. That's the present. And then when he's got the gun parcel taped to his back, they pick some Christmas tape. But that's kind of all there is, apart from Let It Snow at the very end. I mean, you could crowbar all of those references in Die Hard into, like, I don't know, Skyfall or another action movie, and it wouldn't be a Christmas movie. And therefore, and the other big question, you know, would you watch Die Hard at any other time of year? You know, you couldn't say this about Elf or any of the Christmas classics, Scrooged. But, you know, I've enjoyed Die Hard in July.
You maniac. Absolute maverick.
I mean, does someone want to field this? This is...
You go first.
Let me strip to my vest first before we take this out.
All right, I'm going to loosen my tights. So, first of all, features a real-life Grinch as the villain in Hans Gruber, who is basically trying to steal Christmas. It has three, not one, but three amazing Christmas songs. Let It Snow, Run DMC's Christmas in Hollis, and Winter Wonderland. There is, as Chris mentioned at the start, a Christmas miracle courtesy of Hans Gruber. You asked for a miracle, I give you the FBI. And there's even a Santa in a lift, which we all know is the modern-day chimney, who actually says, ho, ho, ho. So, I mean, there is, for starters, and if you want to get religious on this, Bruce Willis, a.k.a. John McClane, spends the whole movie talking to Al, Officer Sergeant Powell, a man who he doesn't know what he looks like, he can't see, and yet he trusts, and he opens up to him about his deepest fears and his insecurities, and eventually, Sergeant Powell, as we're calling him in this, guides John McClane back into the light. Boom! It's a Christmas movie!
Hang on, are you saying that Sergeant Powell is Noel Edmonds?
No, it's Clarence. This is the It's a Wonderful Life Cinematic Union.
Right, Nero. Sorry.
This is his next gig once he gets promoted.
Well, if you're going to say all that stuff, fine. But I think my stuff about the props department still stands.
It should be noted that this is based on a Roderick Thorpe book, Nothing Lasts Forever, which is also set at Christmas time, although it takes place over 3 days instead of one night. I spoke to both writers, Steve D'Souza and Jeb Stewart, about this, and director John McTiernan, and all of which maintain it is in fact a Christmas movie. In fact, they're saying that so Christmas is the setup. It's the only reason they could come up with for the building to be empty. That's all in the original novel. And when you get into it, if you think about it, the whole thing is a cockle-warming tale of an absentee father and husband being reunited with his family at Christmas time. There is nothing more festive than this. Obviously, some terrorists get in the way and he has to kill a bunch of people. That's by the by. But, you know, it ends in that beautiful moment. He's been shot. He's got a bullet hole in his shoulder. You know what I mean? It's so Christmassy. It feels really festive. I think Christmas livery goes all the way through it. And also, it ends just as Christmas morning is kind of breaking. I think that's kind of crucial. So it starts at Christmas Eve, it ends in the early hours of Christmas morning, just as Santa's doing his rounds.
Okay, so there we go. It's settled. It's a Christmas morning.
Great. If you look really carefully, you can see the reindeer in the final shot of the film.
That just took 11 minutes.
You said wrap it up quick at the beginning. I just thought I'd chuck the hand grenade in there.
What are we going to talk about for the next 11 minutes? Amazing. We should also mention that at the end, it's snowing. It's snowing the money.
Snowing bearables.
At the end, which was the addition. It was a suggestion by one of the co-producers in the film, I think, Lloyd Levin, who went on to produce the greatest movie of all time, Event Horizon. So he knows what he's talking about.
I put that in the top 10. That is a great movie.
Well, the top 10 of movies titled Event Horizon.
I really
love it.
I didn't come here to hear shit said about Event Horizon.
Do you see? Yeah? Do you see?
Don't worry, this is the Event Horizon shit-free zone.
Good.
It's all good.
Good.
It's all good.
I chewed Sean Pertwee's ear off at a bar once going, tell me everything about Event Horizon.
Did you? Or did you just got to go, Liberate tutta me ex infernis? He's like, what the fuck?
We thought it was Liberate me, but it's Liberate tutta me. Save yourselves.
This ship is fucked. So we've gone completely off topic.
Also, a Christmas movie.
I was going to say, we don't know when Event Horizon
place in set, or do we? I think it actually does say it takes place in November or December. Therefore,
it's there the you go. Greatest Christmas movie ever made.
Dr. William Weir's the Santa. Can I just pick you up on one thing, Alex? You said there that the lift is the modern day chimney.
Right, yes.
Really? I mean, you don't get kids huddled around an elevator on Christmas Eve waiting for the thud of presents from the roof.
The ding of presents, surely.
The ding of presents. Do you?
And plus, you know he's coming as well. He's coming, 10, 9. He's going to be here, Mom. He's going to be here.
Any second now.
I grew up in a tower block in Leeds. that was where we waited. So obviously, we didn't have chimneys, but if you want to undo my childhood, Chris.
How much time do you have? All right, so we've established, I think, pretty firmly, Dave. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I know. It's good.
Die Hard
I'm just
is...
going to say that now. I've got nothing on Event Horizon in my phone notes either, so I've got not a lot to contribute to the podcast, but it's great being here. I feel like a competition winner. I'm going to hang out with the guys from Sky and Empire magazine. This is excellent.
So is Die Hard, I mean, it's a great Christmas movie. What does it mean to you? When did you first see it? Dave, you saw it at the weekend.
And it turns out I missed a lot of the subtle undercurrents when it comes to the festive period.
Yeah. But you'd seen it before, Dave.
No, it's
obviously.
Well, I had seen it before. I've seen it many times before, and it's a wonderful film. I think, we all agree that it's Alan Rickman on absolutely fine form as a villain that kind of set the bar for many villains to come. I still think, even though he kind of kills a lot of people, it's an act of terrorism, the worst thing he ever did was giving that Joni Mitchell CD to Emma Thompson in Love Actually. When she thinks she's going to get the gold necklace and it goes to the personal assistant lady, that's the worst. And I look at Hans Gruber and I think, just put away the Joni Mitchell CD, Hans. But he's great. It's weird seeing Bruce Willis with hair because I hadn't seen it in a while. When he suddenly pops up, you go, oh, Bruce Willis with hair. I don't like Bruce Willis with hair. I like a bald Bruce Willis. Yeah, I prefer a bald Bruce Willis.
I tell you,
Pulp Fiction is how I like my Bruce Willis.
Terry Gilliam once called Bruce Willis's bald head a monument to cranial architecture. And I love that quote. I love Bruce Willis. I love bald Bruce Willis. But I tell you, I don't like bald John McClane. So that's where Die Hard 4 doesn't feel like John McClane.
But that's because as Bruce Willis became more and more bald, so John McClane became more and more bald, so he lost every attribute that we see in Die Hard that makes you like John McClane. He went from being this vulnerable character who you could relate to, who gets glass in his feet, who's like, at the very start, I mean, just take the opening scene in Die Hard. At the time, we're surrounded by, the mid-80s, you've got Stallone, you've got Arnie, these indestructible heroes. There was absolutely no way either of them would open a movie with digging their fingernails into the armrest of a seat and showing that level of vulnerability. Arnie, that guy with the make fists with your toes, Arnie would have he would have had some nonsensical comeback that he
would shoot your toes.
But he would be like, I prefer to make fists with my fists, fly boy. He'd have got off the aircraft via the landing gear or something for no discernible reason. So it's like you get this guy who, I was a massive geek at school, and even I, when I first watched Die Hard, I was like, yeah, but if I was in that situation, I'd definitely react like John McClane. So you just suddenly go, wow. But I will say, at the same time, Hans Gruber, there are moments in that film where you want to be Hans Gruber, and that's rare for a villain.
The entire film, right, I would like.
But then D'Souza talks about this. In fairness, we should mention this.
This is also true, but D'Souza talks about this, and he was saying that in his head, the way he wrote sections of it, because he wrote all of it. Jeb Stuart wrote the first script, D'Souza polished it and put all the fun stuff in. But the way he talks about it, he saw Gruber as the protagonist of the film. Okay.
Right, in the sense that basically John McClane, if John McClane hadn't been there, Hans Gruber's plan would have just been like, right, steal the money and off he goes. He's the protagonist,
There's something beautiful about watching what the 80s thought really advanced computer technology would be like and just how layman's terms it is. It's just kind of, could you please hack into the mainframe on the 8th floor? Yes, I can. I'm doing that right now for you. Thank you very much indeed. And it's lovely to watch that idea of just how accessible computers would be with an 80s eye on things.
But remember when he arrives at the Nakatomi Plaza and he's like looking for Holly McClane, when he's just keyed in and he goes, what's a touch screen? And he's touching it, it's an 8-bit graphics. And apparently they were all really impressed by that. But also that
cute
scene makes no sense. Because he asks for his wife, the guy says, touch it into the thing, and he goes, 30th floor, and the guy goes, yeah, they're the only ones left in the building. At which point she just said, could we not have fucking started there? And you just pointed me to the lift.
Oh, jobs worth everywhere.
Honestly.
Anyway,
I love the character, the hacker in it, the computer nerd.
Theo
is a great character. And weirdly, what John McTiernan did was if he saw certain actors having, I guess, more fun with their character than other actors, he'd keep them alive longer. I think it was Steve D'Souza who said this, because Theo was meant to, like, cark it. Bruce Willis, John McClane, was meant to kill Theo. But because they added in at the 11th hour the McClane and Hans Gruber meeting when they heard that Alan Rickman could do an American accent, they were like, fantastic, let's have the meet now, because he's not seen him. He can do the accent. And so Theo in that scene was meant to die but got saved. And they were like, save Theo because he's having fun. You didn't bring me along for my charming personality.
Well, Al Leong was another one who would have died earlier, but he improvised that scene where he eats the Hershey bar and he starts chomping on it. And D'Souza was like, oh, he's great, I like him. Like, because he had personality. So D'Souza was like, okay, so I pushed him to the end. Like, he's one of the last to die.
Yeah, because Al Leong's like a legendary bad guy. He's the guy who tortures Mel Gibson in Lethal Weapon with the electrodes.
Less good is James, the terrorist James, who's one of the guys with the rocket launch who torches the car. That's Viggo the Carpathian from Ghostbusters 2.
Yes, it is. Yeah. In the painting.
Scourge
the man
Carpathia,
in the painting.
Sorrow of Moldavia and shit terrorist.
You are like the buzzing of flies to him.
That's exactly it.
Is he also the guy who is in The Money Pit?
Oh, that's Carl. That's the main...
I recognise one of the other blonde villains.
The main henchman,
That's right,
okay.
He's Alexander a ballet Godunov. Dancer, yeah. He was a ballet dancer.
Because he's a conductor
Russia.
In The Money Pit, isn't he?
Mm. Absolutely. And he was massive, with that great big long hair.
What do you guys think of The Money Pit? Sorry, to derail.
Love The Money Pit.
Okay, good. That needs a revisit.
Carl. Should we do a podcast on that as well?
Let me watch it. Come back with a load of facts that are wrong. Alex can correct me. Embarrass me, even though we've been friends for 15 years, and I can go home.
To go back to Carl, though, and to go back to crediting, like, you know, it's the start of Deadpool. The writers are the unsung heroes of this film. I mean, the level of sort of detail that they give each of these characters, I mean, like, you know, everyone in this movie, from the news reader to, like, the guy on the plane, you believe they all have backstories. And Carl and his brother, who I think is called Tony.
Tony, the world's worst-dressed terrorist.
Just that tracksuit. That tracksuit.
That was at GQ this year, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Is it weird that I find it really disconcerting every time you find out how small his feet are? Because he's so tall.
Yes. The only guy with feet smaller than my little sister.
Right, yeah.
Yes, I've got a quote from the film! Yes!
But that whole scene where Carl's chopping the phone lines before Tony's finished, like, doing whatever he's doing.
What a dick.
You get so much of their brotherly relationship in that incidental scene. You're like, Carl was clearly the one who got all the girls. Tony was at home, you know, getting dressed up for his reenactment society. And, like, then suddenly you just, like, the whole thing sort of comes together. And you're like, you make up this backstory.
And we get to hear the German for what I can only assume is you massive bellend. So that's helpful too.
Although apparently no one actually speaks real German.
Well, they do now. In the original theatrical cut, it was just gibberish and it was just nonsense.
No.
They have since redubbed every single one of the terrorists except for Hans, whose German is still ropey. So, for example, when he says "Schießt dem Fenster," it's "Schießt auf dem Fenster." It's poor German grammar. Yeah. But everyone else's has been corrected. Mm. It was all looped.
But Hans is amazing, isn't he? I think there's a really strong argument to be made that Hans is the greatest villain of all time.
Absolutely.
Without a doubt. Yeah. I mean, the whole quoting Plutarch,
when Alexander saw the breadth of his domain, he wept for the many more worlds to conquer.
Yes.
Benefits of a classical education.
But again, you sort of end up going, well, he's clearly educated. He's clearly come from a wealthy, privileged background.
Even if he does misquote Plutarch, but that's neither here nor there, but go on.
Isn't it via the Twilight Zone?
It's via a number of things. Yeah. No one's quite sure where that comes from.
It's via a last-minute rewrite when no one had Google back then.
But like that whole thing about why he's stealing $650 million in negotiable bearer bonds, you're like, at that point, you're like, well, why? Why does he need them? What happened? Has he fallen on hard times? Is his family money gone? And you're going, you make up that's what the script does. It sows questions that it asks you, the viewer, to then fill in.
There's a nice moment where he releases a group of terrorists from somewhere in the world that he states he's only just heard on. But they sound quite good, so let's let everyone
go. Them in Time magazine.
That's it.
We're going to start doing it in stereo.
My favourite part of that is when he says it and Carl, like, comes through and just goes, just mouth Asian. You're like, what the fuck? But that whole thing's really interesting because the Roderick Thorpe novel, they are eco-terrorists. So it's not the Nakatomi Corporation. It's an oil company and it's about...
Klaxon Oil.
Yeah, Klaxon Oil, absolutely. And they've been doing environmental bad deeds and they're trying to uncover evidence of the misdeeds that they've been doing, which they are very much guilty of. And McTiernan turned down this role a number of times and he had a few conditions for taking it on. One of them was McClane, who was then called John Ford. obviously, was much more of a kind of Fleming-esque hero, much more of a sort of an anti-terrorist expert. He goes, no, he needs to be a flat foot from Jersey. We need to keep it low-key. And he says, no one likes terrorists. Terrorists are depressing, you know. Everyone loves a crook. Everyone loves a criminal. Thieves are funny because they're just about the money. So the whole thing was changed to be...
Two great shouts there. Yeah, absolutely.
That set up the template for Die Hard movies going forward, because they all have, pretty much, they all have a big twist where the bad guy turns out to be someone that you didn't quite think that it was, maybe in A Good Day to Die Hard, or they turn out, you know, there's a bad one like John Amos in Die Hard 2, or it's just a robbery like in Die Hard with a Vengeance. Sorry, I've spoiled three of those movies.
I'm doing really one good. A year, Chris, you know this.
I didn't spoil the fourth one. You're fine for that.
They did that for you.
The thing is that what they all miss, though, is like the cool factor. Like when Hans Gruber walks in that trench coat flowing behind him at the start, you're like, well, he's fucking cool. I mean, he's just fundamentally cool. You juxtapose that with William Sadler as Colonel Stewart.
But naked.
Doing fucking Tai Chi in what looks like a hotel room at the Premier Inn, watching the news completely naked. And you're like, I don't like him. He's weird. Why does he come round at Christmas, Mum?
We've all done it.
We have. It's
We've
true.
All been in the Premier Inn in Colchester.
But I
that
find
one
it
time
really fun
that we don't talk about.
But it's nice that we get together once a year.
I'm naked now.
And then it was last year. You said, why don't we make a podcast out of our next meeting, guys? Everyone watch, oh, I don't know, Die Hard. That'll do.
That's it.
It could have been very different, though, because I mean, a lot of this film did get thrown together on the fly, and one of those was The Look for the Terrorist, which originally was supposed to be, you know, in sort of, you know, tack gear and whatnot. And it was the casting director originally who looked at that and was like, we cannot put Alan Rickman in his first movie role. We cannot put him in, you know, combat fatigues and a flak jacket. And they were like, no, let's dress them like models. And it really, really works, because it's all blouse on jackets and blow dries and stuff. When they first spill out of the truck, which does not have an ambulance in it, it's important that we notice that.
Oh, yeah,
when
true.
They first spill out of that truck, they genuinely look like models on a catwalk. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, although if you were the actor who was playing Tony, it's like, sorry, Tony, we ran out of all the good stuff. You got here late. We got this ill-fitting tracksuit
and some really small shoes.
Alex, you mentioned it there that you root for him in a way. And I always find, every time I watch Die Hard, I kind of hope that he gets away with it.
Yeah.
And I love John McClane as well. I want John McClane to save the day and win. But I also want Hans to kind of be sitting on the beach earning 20% by the end of the movie.
Yeah.
The bit where he actually gets to break the lock and the music swells and it's really
The Ode to Joy.
Yeah, it's majestic and he's won. Yeah. The bad guy has won.
And that expression on his face, the brilliant slow motion shot that Jan de Bont has at the very end where he falls out of the building, which I think they had to use military grade technology to actually achieve at that point.
Yeah, they overcranked the camera.
It was so new. And the expression on his face, like, as initially it's sort of that moment where he's sort of like, he realizes he's falling, and then there's that bit where he realizes he's gonna die and he hasn't won.
Yeah.
And like the sort of internal shock of that, like his self-belief like finally falters. It's just an incredible moment.
Yeah. There's also that lovely bit, I think, as you mentioned it earlier, that where they first meet for the first time, Hans and John, and he's just like, again, like a catwalk model. He's leaning up against the wall, and John's being, you know, very smart in looking at the list of employees. And there's a William somebody, but he calls himself Bill. So he abbreviates the name written on the wall behind him while he's kind of smoking a cigarette. And
Bill,
so I just love
Bill,
that.
Bill Clay.
He's standing on one leg in that shot because he fucked his knee jumping down in the previous scene.
Oh, really?
So that's why you see him. You never see him from the knee down.
Interesting bit about that scene, because initially, because there's a bit of confusion about how and when Bruce Willis, John McClane, realizes that he's not Bill Clay and he's actually Hans Gruber. And you mentioned the ambulance not being in the back of the truck. And so, like, to cover for that, like, because they added the ambulance in later to give Argyle something to do, they had to cut away from an earlier scene when they're getting out of the truck. Like, earlier, McTiernan wanted to cut away so you can't see there's no ambulance. And that was a moment where the terrorists all synchronise watches, and you see that they all got the same watch, and it was going to be a running thing where Bruce Willis eventually realises, hang on, they've all got the same watch, and when he gives Hans the cigarette in that scene, he notices the watch and realises it. But because they cut the earlier scene, it doesn't make sense, but it just makes sense anyway because John McClane works shit out, right?
Hot fact, they were matching Tag Heuer watches and the crew got gifted them at the end of the shoot, and D'Souza never got one and he's really fucked off about it.
That's pretty flimsy evidence to shoot someone on, isn't it?
You've got a Tag Heuer, die!
Yeah, he might have just gone to the same watch emporium. That bit always fascinates me because that's the only time we really see Hans, well, desperately improvising, but we also see that his hair is out of place, which is unusual. And then the next time we see him, it's back in again, so he must have brought Chell with him at some point.
But all the good terrorists do. Yeah.
Yeah. He's got his own personal stylist by the looks of it.
John McClane says to him at that point, whenever it's revealed, and he goes, oh, it's pretty tricky with that accent. You should be on fucking TV with that accent. And I always thought that it wasn't a great accent.
I don't think it's a great accent. I'm great. So pleased you said that.
It's not good.
But because apparently he was doing, like, someone on, the reason that scene came about was, like, someone just, like, casually on set went, oh, can you do an American accent? Those of you UK actors can do American accents. And he was like, well, I can do this one from, I think he'd watched the SNL sketch, the Californians at the time. Yeah. He got, I got a Californian accent. And, like, D'Souza saw it and went, oh, my God, that's brilliant. And calls Joel Silver over and goes, this is brilliant. McTiernan, get it. This is brilliant. We can make than me. And then you sort of watch it and you go, really?
And then when you see him, it's going, oh, don't come here, please, don't come here. You're one of them, aren't you? You're one of them. You're like, what the fuck is that?
Where are you from?
Exactly where are you from?
First time making a movie as well.
First movie role.
I always didn't know that.
Literally, his first movie was Die Hard. I
mean, he just quit, the stage, hadn't he?
Quit at that point. Yeah. You're like, you're not. It's not going to get any better from that moment on.
Because it was Sam Neill, I think, they approached first for the role of Hans. I mean, you never saw everyone. You hear so many stories, but you only really hear about Sam Neill being approached for the role of Hans Gruber, whereas they literally asked everyone who was an actor to play John McClane before going, all right, we'll go with Bruce Willis. And then his agent, Arnold Rifkin, his agent for like 25 years, sort of went, yeah, all right, I'm sensing that you don't have anyone at the moment. I'd like $5 million.
Which was an insane sum at that time.
It made him one of the highest paid movie stars in the world at that point without ever having a big... He was a TV star. Yeah. He'd done two Blake Edwards movies, small movies that hadn't done anything, and he gets $5 million. And apparently the day after it emerged that he got $5 million, everyone else's salary in Hollywood went up because actors are going, I kind of won awards and I'm not getting $5 million. So Bruce Willis is responsible for the spiraling fees that actors get.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing? I think it's a good thing, right?
He earned that money. To me, I'm like,
it was $5 million plus $640 million in negotiable bare bones.
That's his money at the end of the movie.
It's Bruce's salary.
He's just throwing great big sacks of cash around.
I can do with it what I like, and this is what I want to do. Ready cameras 1 through 7.
Yeah, but no one take it. Pick it up again.
The whole plan was his agent sorted it so that even if it flopped, like, he'd still be all right because he had $5 million. So it was like, I'll take it.
Coming from moonlighting, as you just said, it's going to work out for me either way. But, I mean, you say, obviously, there's so many different actors have been associated with so many famous roles. But as we are talking about Die Hard, and as we've just been talking about Alan Rickman, it's so important just to pause for a moment and go, thank goodness that one worked out. Nothing against Sam Neill or anything else, but that's one of the great movie roles.
Mm-hmm. It is one of those movies, happy accidents happening in movies. And because you mentioned moonlighting, and Bruce Willis was at the start of the shoot, he was sort of juggling doing moonlighting with shooting Die Hard, and it was like killing it.
He was literally moonlighting.
He was moonlighting. Yeah,
bloody hell.
And John McTiernan was like to Steve D'Souza, he's like, look, we're kind of killing Bruce here. Can you maybe just write some stuff for the other actors to do, which is how we get like such rich characters. Like they wrote more for the whole Hans and Holly stuff came about because they just introduced this idea of Holly being the sort of figurehead for all the hostages and sticking up for them because they didn't have Bruce because he was asleep.
That's right. Yeah, that was the first extra bit that D'Souza wrote was that scene between Bonnie Bedelia and Alan Rickman, which is great.
Yeah.
The way she comes in, she's like, we want bathroom breaks. He's clearly back-footed by it, which I really love.
Put you in charge.
Yeah. You did. You did when you killed my boss.
good point.
The other thing, with my first child is going to be born soon, and when he or she gets a little older, I'm looking forward to, not like many people would, with the little discarded Legos around the front room. I'm looking forward to being able to bandage up my feet and walk around in like shards of glass.
Walk in the room going,
his dad's got his vest on again. He's rolling around on the floor.
Lock up the bare bones. Lock up the bare bones.
He's throwing 20p's from the roof.
Just got some gaffer tape on your back because you couldn't find the Christmas sellotape.
The pistol,
such a shame. Austerity Britain. That's what everyone's got to make cuts.
Budget Die Hard. There's something to talk about.
Die Hard with the Brexit. Anyway, we're getting political. Let's not get political, people. Let's move on. So we talked about Hans Gruber and how amazing he is, but we haven't really talked about John McClane.
I like that John McClane is the antidote to, as Alex was saying, to your Schwarzeneggers, to your Stallones, that he is an everyday guy. He's just a policeman. He's not exceptional particularly in any way. I mean, he doesn't have any fucking shoes. do you know what I mean? And the fact that he's very wry and he's quite wisecracking, you know, that was a really interesting
thing. And scared.
Thing. And clearly scared. And, yeah. and why it works is he's on his own, let's be honest, for most of the film. So they have him talking to himself so that you have some dialogue happening. And one of the reasons why he gets his feet cut up was because they worried that he was coming across, frankly, as a dick.
Yeah.
Because he's constantly sarcastic. So they wanted to humanise him. They wanted to make him feel really vulnerable. And I think that really works. And he does feel out of his depth throughout the whole film, which is one of the main appeals of that character. Love him. Love him to bits.
I think that's where they go wrong with certainly 4 and 5.
Yes.
Because by then he's a Superman. Superhuman yeah.
And
he's
he was never
used
meant
to
be that.
Just jumping onto jet fighters yeah. and punching people in traffic in Russia as if it was just a normal Wednesday for him.
He became exactly the antithesis of what John McClane was meant to be. He became those indestructible heroes that John McClane was the antidote to in Die Hard.
Yeah.
Just the fact that he sits up front in the limousine, you know, like he's an everyday guy. You know, he's not a special guy. He sees himself on a level with Argyle or Basil Exposition, as we like to call him at the beginning of the film. But, you know, it's, yeah, he's...
Come on, tell me. Tell me your story. Tell me. Come on, tell me.
Okay, so this is my backstory. Here we go. Trouble with my wife. You, your car.
Okay, good. A bit more, a bit more. Got a long drive.
And then, of course, a conversation that ends with the line, this is Christmas music. Going back to our original conversation.
See, Dave Barry. Christmas right from the off. Right from the motherfucking yes. off.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Where do you stand on Bruce and John?
Well,
he's got hair in this, but can you get past
Yeah, no, it was just weird to see because I hadn't watched it in such a long time. It was weird to see Bruce Willis with hair, but I absolutely love him as well. It's that this shit happening to this guy is exactly what it's all about. And you do, and Alex said it brilliantly, Arnold Schwarzenegger would have come up with a way of not being a scaredy cat on an aeroplane.
Mm-hmm.
And you're so right about that. And it just sets him up perfectly. And also that seems fascinating about taking the shoes away because otherwise he was coming across as a bit of a dick. They made so many right calls, didn't they? And they made a lot of those calls on the fly, but they were all absolutely spot on. To give us two great movie characters. Yeah.
One call he made right from the off was, I think, everything about this movie is one of the greatest things for me,
yeah.
but the setting, the location, Nakatomi Plaza, yeah. which, of course,
the
is
building.
The Fox building in L.A. Yeah.
Have you ever seen it in real life?
Oh, yes.
I've been inside it.
Oh, yes.
You've
been inside it.
Yeah. Are there floors still under construction?
Sadly not.
There's no roof.
Is there a little snowman lamp even in July? I rest my fucking case.
There is. I went to the roof and tried to order a pizza. It didn't go well.
How many people do you think wander into security and go, hi, I'm looking for Holly McClane? Get out. Get the fuck out. You're the fifth guy today.
Oh, what's this touchscreen thing? I've never seen one of these before.
Did you make loads of fire engines drive towards it and they go, no, no, come on, you asshole! Turn the truck around!
Yeah, I don't get a taxi there. I get a helicopter, a low-flying helicopter.
Sir, could you please unshackle yourself from that fire hose?
Here's a hot fact for you. One of the most expensive effect shots in that entire film is when Argyle is driving Bruce from the airport to Nakatomi, you see a shot of the Nakatomi Plaza, and they had to remove all of the phone wires, all the telegraph poles, because they just crisscrossed the entire thing and they ruined the view. So all of that had to be removed, and it drove McTiernan insane.
That's fascinating.
And of course, you would have no idea because it's a completely invisible shot. But they wanted that shot of the building, and they had to take them all out.
And of course, they shot like nearly all the movie in the building. I think the main ballroom, the party room where they're all gathered, that's a set, and they've
the
got
a huge
sort of matte skyline in the background. But everything else was actually
all the construction. Under construction floors were under construction floors.
And they wrote the bit in because they found these floors under construction. They didn't, that was a, you know, we talk about happy accidents in cinema. That was because they were like, great, let's set a scene here.
Well, McTiernan's insistent you would never have had the film if they'd not had access to that building. So no one will lend you a skyscraper. It's just not going to happen. Mm. But they just happened to have one. But Fox had rented out a number of the floors. So there were companies on there. There was a law firm or whatnot, which was constantly apparently threatening to sue because the gunfire was driving them insane.
You're going to sue us? Find a lawyer. What?
But it is amazing. So were Fox using it at that time?
Well, they were moving into it. Yeah, it was their building. So it was newly acquired. So they were renovating parts of it. But yes, they were occupying it.
And the office where... Ellis Cox, it eventually became the office of former President of the United States, Ronald Reagan.
Reagan.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my God, really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they,
Alex saying bringing the knowledge.
It's true. I think urban myth says that there were still kind of like spent cartridges on the floor there. Whether or not that's true, I do not know.
And the body of Hart Bocker.
Yeah, exactly. Is this guy on the floor?
You think someone would have moved them out by now?
You would.
I love that building. Every time I'm in LA, I have to take a selfie with it. Yeah. it's like a building. Just stand there.
Okay. It is. It's Action Cinemas Overlook Hotel. It is. It's a fantastic building. You mentioned Hart Bochner. We have to discuss him, right?
Of course. All right, of course. Ellis, who is one of the great. One of the great cinematic sleazebags.
But
wasn't Hart Bochner's MO at the time? Like, he was more of a classic leading man type.
Yeah.
So he was playing very much against type, and McTiernan didn't like the way he played it. He told him to play like Cary Grant. That was his whole thing. And Joel Silver was like, no, up the arsehole, more.
I beg your pardon.
let's not isolate the audio, Chris.
Figuratively.
It was a movie set in the 80s. A movie set in the 80s.
That's not how you take cocaine.
A different time.
Well, he does go for maximum arsehole. I think we can all agree. Coked off his tits.
But it was like, it wasn't done sort of privately when McTiernan said that. He went up to him. He saw him, the way he was playing, it was this sort of jittery kind of thing. He goes up to him and goes, "What are you doing? I hate it. I actually hate it. Stop doing that." Because he wanted like a Cary Grant kind of like smooth talking guy to sort of balance out McClane. I mean, and the fact that Hart Bochner goes, "I'm going to carry on doing it like this," and then the following day, John McTiernan goes up to him and goes, "I said to you yesterday, stop doing this." And then McTiernan sees Joel Silver laughing at the rushers and goes, "Give me a second." Goes over, comes back and goes, "Yeah, do it how you want to do it."
We should, however, talk about the one unresolved controversy of this film, which is, of course, the etymology of Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker, which eludes everyone, including the makers of this film.
Go on.
Jeb Stuart goes with Steve D'Souza's line. Steve D'Souza insists that it came out of a conversation. So Bruce Willis has said he ad-libbed it, which is nonsense because I own the shooting script and it's fucking in it. so he clearly didn't do that. But D'Souza says that he and Bruce used to talk about Roy Rogers and how they loved the Roy Rogers show, and he used to sign off with, not Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker, but he used to sign off with Yippee-ki-yay. That's apocryphal. It's just not true. And if you look into it, Roy Rogers never said that. What he used to say was Happy Trails, which is, I think, where that line comes from, the Happy Trails Hans. But if you look up Yippee-ki-yay, it does come from, and I now have to look this up because I've completely forgotten the name of it. If anyone remembers it.
No, I'm happy to just come. Okay. Mark some time.
Every lift gag in every movie. What was that? That's Deep Rising.
Have you found it yet, James?
Hang on.
Chimney gag, whichever way you look at it.
You're killing me here.
I will say this about Yippee-ki-yay. I mean, while Yippee-ki-yay is... We can't say that.
Of course we can.
Really?
Of course we can.
All right, Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker.
I can't believe you said that.
Beat me. bite me, but beat me. The best Yippee-ki-yay was when it was screened on ITV in the 90s, and they dubbed the Yippee-ki-yay motherfucker into, and the person they got to dub it sounds like John Hurt, not Bruce Willis, and it goes, Bruce Willis goes, "Yippee-ki-yay, kimusabi."
Yes. Oh, I used to love those TV dubs.
Yep. Yippee-ki-yay, kimusabi.
They used to go very Harry Enfield, like Muddy Funsters and things like, it was quite extraordinary. But no, actually, I've looked it up. The only place it has been found is Bing Crosby did a song called "I'm an Old Cowhand" in the 1930s, which he sings "Yippee-yi-yo-ka." So that's as close as you'll get to it.
That was worth the wait.
To go back a step, James, you own the shooting script to Die Hard.
I've got the blueprints of the Nakatomi Plaza as well.
Because I'm planning the next crime.
I'm not saying I'm guilty of anything, but yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
Because those were the actual blueprints. In the movie, the one that Hans is poring over, is they're the real blueprints that they actually got to the building to work out where to shoot. They're not a prop.
Yeah, no, they referred to the floors because they wanted to keep track of where everyone was going, where the hostages were, where he was at any given time. And the reason that you have the Playboy model there was to give you a sense of geography. It wasn't just
because he kind of like touched her for luck.
To show, you're supposed to think, oh right, he's back there, like he's back at the top of the lift shot. So it was to give you a sense of geography. That's why they put it in.
It does really well because so many action movies don't do that. You're like, who are they? Where are they? What's going on? But that, you do get the geography of that building.
So we're all going to gather at Fox Plaza December 24th, pull one last job, put all this stuff behind us forever.
I thought we were going to the Holiday Inn in Colchester again, Chris.
as long as
23rd,
as long as when you arrive, I can lean out of a window and go, "Welcome to the party, pal!"
It's done. It's a done deal.
That's a great line. We should do our favorite lines. I honestly, for some reason, the line that makes me giggle the most is "Welcome to the party, pal." After he's dropped the body,
sounds like you say it a lot.
Weirdly enough, my favorite line from Total Recall is "See you at the party, Richter."
See you at the party, Richter. Oh, that's great.
For some reason, I just really like people falling from great heights and references to parties.
No, oh my god,
that's the one I wrote down. That's the one. "Welcome to the party, pal," was the one I wrote down.
That's good.
Yeah, that's true.
But the thing is, like, the most quoted line for me from Die Hard is the most random, which is just ladies and gentlemen, due to the Nakatomi Corporation's legacy agreed around the globe, they're about to be taught a lesson in the true meaning of power.
I usually stop you after ladies and gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen. The rest of it's not quite as memorable.
Very true. We have talked about this on the podcast many times, but I am going to bring this. Alan Rickman came to the Empire Awards once, and there was a point where he was at the buffet helping himself to a Caesar salad, and Chris and I were standing just out of earshot, just going, "Ladies and gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, where are the croutons?" And we like to think that secretly he could hear us.
Because we didn't have the nerve to go up to him. Because we thought he would be able to see two diehard fanboys coming a mile away and going, "I've done Shakespeare, nerve."
Oh, that's nice, though, to see him up close at the buffet. It was a good enough story.
It was amazing.
I interviewed, obviously, the hero of the piece, Bruce Willis, at the Good Day to Die Hard premiere on the red carpet. And I mean, we've talked about how he can be difficult. I maintain that he's just got a fascinating sense of humour. So I walked up to him and I was holding the microphone in front of him, and like it was going out on the PA in Leicester Square for everyone to hear. And he's going and talking so quietly the microphone can't pick him up. So I have people in my ear going, "Move the microphone closer, move the microphone closer." So I move the microphone closer and he's going, "Bruh, bruh," and it gets louder and he can hear himself, and he puts his hand on my forearm and just moves the microphone back down and carries on going, "Bruh, bruh, 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 bruh." And I've got people screaming in my ear going, "Move it back, move it closer." And like, I went to see them afterwards and I'm like, "I didn't move it closer, because if John McClane moves a microphone away from his mouth, you don't move it back."
Do you think he had people in his ear going, "Move the microphone away"?
What would have been great as well is if just right at the end he'd gone, "So anyway, that was a surprise to us all."
And that's the plot for Die Hard 6.
Exactly. Anyway, I'll never see her again. Bruce!
And I said, even if it is a cat, I'm not going to eat it.
I love the "I'm an exceptional thief, Mrs. McClane, and since I'm moving up to kidnapping, you should be more polite." I absolutely love that. It's amazing.
Everything,
and it could be adapted
says.
For anything in life. Yeah. "I'm an exceptional bus driver, and since I'm moving up to taxis, you should be more polite." What's your favourite moment? What's your favourite diehard moment?
"Send in the car! Send in the car!" That is such a good line.
I love
the fact he says it twice. "Send in the car! Send in the car!" And then amazing. I only worked out, here's an admission, I only worked out probably a couple of years ago, I'd never heard the term RV. So when Theo goes, "Oh,
the police have got themselves an RV.
I was like, "That probably means military vehicle of some kind, like a sort of response vehicle." I didn't know it was a joke.
Yeah. Oh,
Jimbo, your favourite moment?
So many. One of the little grace notes I like is that when they send in the car and when they send in the SWAT team, one of the SWAT members pricks his finger on a rose. Yes. He just goes, "Ah!" And it tells you exactly what you need to know about what's about to happen, because they are completely outmatched. That was apparently an ad-lib by the actor, which McTiernan liked and asked him to then do it in subsequent takes.
Yeah.
But I thought that's a really nice moment. And I think there are those little moments of comedy all the way through, whether it be Al Leung eating the Hershey bar, and then I think he has another one. He's like a Babe Ruth. I think he gets through quite a lot of them.
Yeah,
the Nestle Crunch. And I think there's a Babe Ruth as well.
Yeah,
I mean, he cleans up in that concession stand. Oh, we
haven't even talked about Paul Gleason as Dwayne T. Deputy Chief of Police Dwayne T. Robinson.
Weirdly enough, Al Leung is possibly the only successful thief in the movie.
he actually gets away with some candy.
He's dead by the end, but he actually stole and ate the candy.
That's true.
Technically, of course, Theo and one other thief. I'm not going to call him terrorists.
Christoph.
Live.
Yeah, Christoph.
So there's your sequel right there. Forget this, Die Hard 6 origin tale of McClane, because this is the origin tale of John McClane, this right here, not some guy filling out paperwork, which is what the other movie would be. So they should make the Die Hard 6. Theo gets out of prison. He's pissed. He wants revenge. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Hollywood. Please send a check to the Empire Podcast.
I am worried about the, what's he now entitled, McClane.
McClane.
I just like, McClane. Die Hard works, like, because it's, you know, it's a guy in a single location, like, fighting against an unstoppable amount of people. This whole idea of sort of flitting between young John McClane and then Bruce Willis in the current day, it's like, no, every scene where Bruce Willis isn't on the screen, you're going to be like, yeah, when are we getting back to Bruce Willis?
Yeah. Dave, what's your favourite Die Hard moment?
We've already touched on them. I love the bit that the guy's quite read it word for word, which is very nice, but I love the bit where he asks for the release of the other group of terrorists because he's just read about them in Time magazine. Yeah. I think that encapsulates the fun that Alan Rickman was having with Hans Gruber. And I like the meeting of the two characters for the first time.
Yeah.
Terrible American accent or not. it was quite nice to see them in the same kind of what air vent for the first time. So two good moments.
Absolutely.
Okay. I like the fact, literally it's the bit where he like watches the girl in the tight
fucking
white thing.
California. Yeah.
California. Because every time you land in LA, you just sort of go, what the fuck is this place? And it just like you suddenly go, he's me. And the whole point of him being an everyman, I'm like, good, I get it, right? Everyone's beautiful here, and you go, fucking California.
Right, we got to wrap this bad boy up. So I know people who haven't seen Die Hard, amazingly enough.
Wow.
So what would you say to them this festive season to get them to see it, Dave?
It is definitely a wonderful Christmas movie. Two people know a lot more about it than I do.
You've
have
really
made
turned
that
around
perfectly
this.
Clear. I think watch it for Alan Rickman being absolutely fantastic and redefining from the 1980s what a villain can be in the movie world. That would be my piece of advice.
All right. Good, good, good. James?
Oh, my God. All of those reasons and more. I just think it's your moral imperative to watch it. In fact, I'm commanding you to watch it. And I will say I'm going to count to three. There will not be a four.
All right, good, good, good. It's the perfect Christmas Eve movie, isn't it, Alex? I mean, that's...
I'll take it under advisement.
Take this under advisement. Trickweed.
I didn't know that Bane was in it.
Yes, watch this. Speak of the devil and he shall appear.
I was born in the dark, but clearly not in Germany, where I'm supposed to be from. Hoggy, goggy, goggy.
Hokey, cocky, cocky.
Oh, Shabbat, a Bonhof, yeah.
No, why? Because you asked for a miracle. I give you Die Hard this Christmas.
Yippee-ki-yay, motherfuckers.
Wow. That's all the time we have, I'm afraid. If this has got you all stoked up to see Die Hard, perhaps for the first time, then you are in luck. It is available exclusively on Sky Cinema this Christmas from December 1st as part of Sky Cinema's biggest ever on-demand Christmas movie collection, including The Muppet Christmas Carol. Oh, that's a classic. Frozen, Bad Santa, yes. It's a Wonderful Life, to name but four, which we now know is a pre-make of Die Hard. Thanks to Alex. But that's not all. Sky Cinema will have their biggest ever premiere lineup this Christmas, including Avengers Infinity War, yes, The Shape of Water, The Greatest Showman, classic films already. So there's something for everyone to watch whenever you want this Christmas. Visit sky.com/Sky Cinema for details on how to subscribe. And while I'm directing you towards websites, if you feel feverishly that Die Hard is a Christmas film, or equally strongly that it isn't, then go to isdiehardachristmasfilm.com.
Don't do it. They'll tear you apart, man. I tried it, guys. Don't do it. Get out while you can.
To join the debate. Dave will be on there.
On my own in a chat room.
I'm setting up another website. It's called Die Hard Is a Christmas Movie.
I think we're outnumbered, Dave.
Yeah. Alex is on there as Hans Gruber Rocks. Dave is on there as I've Just Seen Die Hard.
I got the wrong end of the stick.
It is a classic, classic film.
It is.
All that remains for me after saying Christmas a whole bunch of times is to say farewell, Merry Christmas, and yippee-ki-yay, motherfuckers, to Alex Sane.
Woo!
That was the most un-Hollywood-like.
Woo!
Yeah, that's all right.
I'll do it again.
No, it's fine. It was good.
Okay.
We're at one-take deals around here.
You can't do that again.
See you at the party, pal! Wait, no, Richter. What?
Woo!
Dave Berry.
Yippee-ki-yay and a Happy New Year, everyone.
Oh, see that? He didn't just lean back and go,
Woo! I got excited.
Also, we should all put our coats on because it's raining dogs and cats outside.
Oh.
You don't know what I'm talking about, do you?
No. What?
It's how he finds out that they're terrorists in the Die Hard sequels when he says instead of it's raining cats and dogs, he said it's raining dogs and cats.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you, Alex.
You can't drop the knowledge bomb this late in the day, honestly.
Why didn't you do this an hour ago? I thought you were going to be really impressed with that. I'm going.
That's good. That was good.
Oh, no, good. You were. You could tell by the blank looks in our faces. Like, that we were really
it was very polite of you to go, you're nice people. You can tell you're nice people.
Good.
Okay,
how can the good. Same shit happen to the same guy twice? Am I right?
And Scoop by Merry Christmas and Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker, from James Dyer.
Happy trails, Chris.
And also from me. Thank you so much for joining us. Perhaps we'll do this again next year, either in an airport or the Premier Inn in Colchester. Thanks so much for listening. See you next time. Bye.